This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech, continuing the oral history interview with James D. Evans, a veteran of the U.S. Army. Today's date is the 13th of April, 2004. I, again, am on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building in the interview room, and Dr. Evans is in Dallas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Jim, I'd like to begin by asking you, with regard to the time period that you were serving in Quang Tri and in that area, about the MedCAPS program and whatever interaction you had with that effort.
Okay. I was basically told to go on. Lieutenant Paul Sauer, the mm-hmm. Medical Service Corps lieutenant, had been, going on, and, he's, fortunately, he knew the area. So I went on a few in November, but it was like I didn't feel like we were providing, any effective medical care because, the people knew that Robitussin tasted good, so they all came in and they would go, because they were coughing they wanted Robitussin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like it was handing out candy.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't feel like we were doing anything effective. And, from what I heard from Paul Sauer, who arrived in Quang Tri, I think July 1969, that, there was not a lot of consistency. They were not going back to the same places time after time.
Jim, when you said that you were kind of pretty much told to go on them, where did that come from?
This is coming from, I guess brigade.
Okay.
The battalion surgeons, if they were not, like we were in Quang Tri combat days.
Sure.
Then we went out, we were supposed to go on the MedCAPS. And, I don't know whether the previous battalion surgeon was named Lightburn went on MedCAPS or not.
Mm-hmm.
He left before I arrived.
Right.
Uh-huh. So one of the first ones I went to was near Wonder Beach, which I think is where the 1st of the 5th Infantry Brigade came on land.
Okay, right.
And it was on Highway 555.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out there in a Jeep. There were several medics, Paul Sauer, and we took care of the people. And then the local militia, wanted all of the medicine. It was in a metal chest. And so they pulled their weapons on us.
Now, how many were there? How many of you and how many of them?
There were probably two or three medics plus Paul Sauer and myself.
Uh-huh.
And probably that many local militia.
Were they in a Jeep or?
No, they were just sort of the locals.
Okay.
The rough puffs, as they were known.
Sure.
And so they pulled weapons locked and loaded, and the medics pulled their weapons out and locked and loaded, like M16s. And so it was just a standoff. No shots were fired. We loaded up. We were thinking of an ambulance, which would carry several of us plus the equipment, and drove off back to the Quang Tri combat base
with the medications
with the medicine. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So but I thought we were going to get killed.
Now were you seriously in fear?
Yes, I was terrified because I realized that we could have been shot. It was a BC area, and, it was just damn scary. And we got back to the battalion, and they're just saying, why are you worried? Why are you upset? And, they would not provide security. So I quit going. Paul Sauer continued to go. As far as I know, there were no, he didn't have any problems. But, you know, he enjoyed being around the Vietnamese. And I was just, I was scared. And I thought it was, you know, it was exercise futility.
Okay.
Because, you know, they had huge, you know, basic health needs, and we certainly weren't addressing them.
And what kind of needs did you see that you just didn't have the resources?
I think, like, basic sanitation.
Okay.
And immunizations are, and, you know, this is part of winning the hearts and minds, and so it was a political ploy and not a medical issue.
Jim, did you raise these concerns at all with the command structure?
What I told the command structure was that, you know, we were not in a secure area.
Okay.
And that I wasn't going unless they provided security.
And that was just a flat-out no?
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't go. I mean, the medics went, but I wasn't going. I thought it was ridiculous. Because, you know, they just said it wasn't, you know, I was creating this problem.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a direct order to go,
mm-hmm.
but I, you know, may have gone one or two in the spring of 70. But I thought we were wasting our time. I realize now, I mean, just talking about, I'm upset.
Okay.
It's fine, but I mean, it's like this immediacy about that situation. And, what we're doing was ridiculous.
Yeah, and it sounds like you just felt that you couldn't have the kind of impact that you needed to have in that situation.
Right. I mean, it is like, as I said, this is part of, you know, winning the hearts and minds.
Yeah.
So it was a political activity.
Mm-hmm.
But it was medically ineffective. That, you know, we would have been far more effective if we had provided, you know, like medical care at the Quang Tri Province Hospital.
Was that a Vietnamese?
It was a Vietnamese hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I went there once, and I've got the photographs are in the slide collection that I sent.
Okay,
So they're like several, maybe two-story buildings. I mean, they were probably dating back to the French era. I was told, I think I met some of the physicians who were like Quakers.
Uh-huh.
There was a woman who I took a photograph of in a Jeep named Vicki Johnson, and I don't know who she was, really.
Mm-hmm.
She was someone that Paul Sauer knew and may have been, you know, a nurse. You know, so I'm not really sure who she was.
Mm-hmm. But she was connected with the hospital somehow?
She appeared to be connected with the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in contact with Nini Fortune about her.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Nini's going to check it out. But,
okay.
But she doesn't know who she was.
What was the occasion for you to visit that hospital, Jim? Do you remember? How did it come about?
Just sort of check out the medical care, see what was available.
Okay.
And just it was a medical interest. I just remember the conditions were very primitive. That was the only time I went.
Right. Yesterday, Jim, we were talking about your putting through some paperwork to get a new assignment after having spent a number of months in the field, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember receiving orders for a new posting?
Yes. I went to Hong Kong, it was like the end of April,
mm-hmm.
I think I came back, you know, like around the 3rd or so put in for transfer probably, you know, 5th or 6th of May, someplace around there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, within 2 weeks, I've got some notes I'll have to find. But
sure.
About 2 weeks, you know, I had orders to go to Da Nang. I think maybe 67th Medical Group. I'm not really sure. I mean, that just is administrative group in Da Nang.
Okay.
That handled the transfer. So I left, you know, I think there was a farewell party with the medics in Quang Tri. And then I flew to Da Nang, and it was traumatic because, you know, I had a lot of luggage, you know, like 2 suitcases, and I lost everything. It was stolen.
It was stolen?
It was never found, but I think it was stolen.
What? You didn't have your photographs in there, I take it?
There were some photographs.
Okay.
You know, one of the packets I'll be sending you has got a list of, you know, what I had and what was lost. And
really?
Estimated value.
Okay.
And the, you know, the search that was done by the military. So when I got the design, you know, all I had a 35 millimeter camera which I carried with me.
Uh-huh.
And I lost everything.
And although we'll be getting a list, what were the things that you most treasured there, Jim, that you lost?
I think, you know, it was some of the photographs.
Yes.
And there was, I guess the one that I missed the most was, I had a few photographs of Bruce Heskett. And he was killed the 29th of June after I left.
How do you spell his last name?
H-E-S-K-E-T-T.
And tell me a little bit about Bruce.
He was a friend of Paul Sowers. They both had gone to University of Notre Dame. He was a lieutenant. You know, just a very pleasant, gentle man.
Was he a medical officer like you?
No, he was with the Armored Battalion.
Okay.
And he was up along the DMZ. He got hit by an RPG.
Okay.
Actually got hit with shrapnel, and then got hit with an RPG. I sent cop, you know, letters that Paul Sauer sent me. One is dated like June, and then he continues the letter. It's like the 3rd of July, and it says bad news. And then it has a details about what happened to Bruce.
Uh-huh.
But what I remember was very eerie was that I had, you know, printed some photographs of that were taken.
Uh-huh.
And in one of the images, Bruce, it was a, like a double exposure.
Uh-huh.
And so Bruce is in this double exposure, but, you know, the image is white. Like an aura.
Okay, right.
And it should have been a dark double exposure. But it's like, I didn't believe in things like that, but like, it was like something bad's happening or going to happen. But I just thought at the time it was like some peculiar photographic, you know, thing that happened.
Some kind of artifact of the
process. Like an artifact.
Uh-huh.
But, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I had this ghost image of this person I knew. But, so I just thought, I just thought it messed up in the photo lab, which, you know, probably is the explanation, but it's like, you know, then he got killed.
And that photograph was one of the things that was lost?
Yes.
Okay. But you have a very clear image in your mind of that.
I've got a very clear image of the photograph that I developed in Quang Tri.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've got like a contact sheet from that.
Really?
So, you know, I lost the negatives, but I do have the contact sheet.
Hmm. Well, it would be very interesting to see that.
Also, what I sent earlier, the pulse hour photographs, there were two or three of Bruce Heskett.
Two or three, I'm sorry?
Two or three photographs
uh-huh.
of Bruce Heskett.
That were included in what you've sent here?
Right.
Okay.
Those were pulse hour photographs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And was Bruce somebody who kind of hung around? How did you get to know him?
Well, as I said, I mean, he was a friend of Paul Sowers.
Okay.
So he would come by, and, you know, he would drop by the Hoosh by the Italian aid station, or he would be in the officers' club that was just a few feet away from the aid station when he was not out in the field. And, you know, I just, you know, I was not that close to him, but I just remember, you know, he just came across as a very good person.
Sure, sure. So that was some very bad, heavy, bad news that you got.
It really was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got the news by letter from Paul. You know, he mailed me the letter, you know, around the second part of the letter is the 3rd of July.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent that letter to me at the 91st Evac Hospital. So I was, you know, went through denying. I went to, I guess, the 67th Medical Group. So then they assigned me to go to Chulai,
mm-hmm.
where the 91st Evac Hospital was located.
Let me just ask here, Jim, whether you were able to stay in contact with Paul through the rest of your and his in-country time.
Okay. When I lost the luggage, I tried to call Quantree. But the telephone communication was just absolutely terrible.
Okay.
I mean, it was virtually impossible to make any direct contact. But I think I did get through, and like in one of the letters, Paul said that he has been checking about the luggage. The NCO for the platoon, Hollis Hibbets, H-I-B-B-I-T-T-S.
Okay.
Was checking. But they didn't find anything in Quantree.
Uh-huh.
And so then I've got one letter from that Paul sent that, you know, I already mailed you all.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, you know, about the 1st of August. And he had gotten out of 1st to 77th in July. He actually had gotten sick, and so missed his de-rust date.
Right.
And so I've got a letter that he wrote like the 1st of August in Monterey, California. And then after I got back
mm-hmm.
to the U.S. in 71, or 72, I visited with him. Probably 71. This is him at his home in Columbus, Ohio.
Can you, I know this is jumping forward a little bit, but,
mm-hmm.
but what was it like to see him again? Was it comfortable? Was it uncomfortable? Can you describe that?
It was comfortable. I mean, he was certainly a very congenial person to be with. We were in the same hooch, you know, from
yeah.
November until early June. And, I mean, he was somebody I could visit with. He helped me with photography.
Right.
You know, he was very good in the platoon with the men. Probably by 72, we lost contact. Or just like what I found was, it was hard to be in contact with people I knew in Vietnam because, you know, I guess the memories it evoked. Part of the way of making it go away was trying, you know, losing contact.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happened basically with you and Paul?
Right.
And have you been in contact with him at any point since then?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me, Jim, a little bit about arriving at Chulai.
Well, I got to Chulai. I went through personal office, and I was told I'd be working in the emergency room. And then I got checked into the BOQ, and it was, you know, just a military issue, wood building. It was a spectacular place to be because it was on a cliff of the South China Sea. And if you looked, you know, toward the north, it looked like the coast of Maine.
Really?
It was rocky. There were reefs. Right below the hospital, there was a rocky reef, small sandy beach. And then toward the south was the USO beach for Chulai that was probably 5 or 6 miles long. I never got to the south end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, you know, spectacular. And, you know, right where I was, I think number 5 BOQ, and there was a big deck, you know, out over the cliff. And so this is where the, you know, medical officers hung out. It's called Boys Camp.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it was like MASH. It was, you know, it was this craziness. We had parties. The parties were usually around booze.
Mm-hmm.
We had Mai Tai parties.
Wow.
And so they put, you know, Mai Tai mix in one of these 5-gallon water dispensers. When they had the Mai Tai party, we couldn't get Mai Tai mix from the PX. So the neurosurgeon, Tim Stuntz, who was also known as Scrounge, you know, he knew people all over Vietnam, so he contacted a helicopter pilot from someplace down south saying, we want to invite you to the party, but bring Mai Tai mix because we can't get it here. So, you know, the pilot comes up, brings the Mai Tai mix, parks his helicopter outside the emergency room helicopter landing pad, and we have the party. The commander of the hospital gets pissed off because, you know, this is a hazard for other helicopters coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted the helicopter removed, and so what happened was somebody decided that, you know, he might have had a closed head injury, and so had to be admitted to the pilot had to be admitted to the hospital for observation.
Right.
So if he was in the hospital, he couldn't fly his helicopter. So they just left the helicopter on the landing pad. I mean, it was a huge, it was a very large landing pad, so it was not really a problem.
Okay. Right.
But that, I mean, that just sort of, you know, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gathered in the evening out on the deck, and so I've got a lot of photographs taken on the deck.
And you guys would hang out there?
Oh, yes.
And de-stress, I imagine?
De-stress. We would have, you know, steak cookouts.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Tim Stunt got steaks. And he's like, basically, you know, at the mess hall, we never saw steaks. We never had them.
Right.
Because they were diverted.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, if you had connections, you could get stuff.
And it sounds like Tim was pretty good at managing that end of things. He had connections.
Well, he was great. I mean, we called him Scrounge.
Okay.
Because, I mean, he had his own Jeep. You know, it was an orphan Jeep.
Uh-huh.
It, you know, didn't belong to the hospital. company commander would just say, Tim, you need to get your Jeep off the facility because we have inspectors coming. And they will check out the equipment, and they're going to want to know, what about this orphan Jeep?
Yeah, right.
And so Tim would just move it someplace else. And, yeah.
Jim, how do you spell his last name?
S-T-U-N-T-Z, I think.
Where was he from?
I don't know.
Okay. You mentioned he was a neurosurgeon.
He was a neurosurgeon, yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Sherry Hawes, who was a nurse at the 9th University Back Hospital, said that Tim was killed in a skiing accident with an avalanche.
Okay.
After he got back.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So, I'm not sure when that happened, but apparently it was, you know, it's not too long after we got back to Vietnam.
Okay. Jim, tell me a little bit about the organization of your work. I'm assuming since you were in the emergency room that you were dealing with casualties as they came off the dust offs. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
There was a large helicopter landing pad right outside the emergency room.
Uh-huh.
And we took care of casualties as they came in, you know, stabilizing them, doing basically physicals, evaluating the injuries, doing blood tests, you know, having blood drawn, starting IVs, deciding, you know, what x-rays needed to be done, if, you know, they required a surgeon for debriding, or there were fractures, or, you know, whatever it was.
Jim, were you actually doing surgeries as well?
No.
Okay. Would you describe what you were doing as kind of triage plus? In other words, you were kind of directing traffic as to where the men needed to be seen next?
Right. It was like triage, stabilization, evaluation, and then, you know, filling out the paperwork and handing the patient on to, you know, the surgeons or whatever needed to be done.
Okay. How many people did you have helping you with each case? Can you describe what the personnel complement was working in the ER?
There was, you know, at least like one NCO. There were medical specialists, the 91 Charlies.
Right.
Medics. There were Vietnamese interpreters.
Okay.
So we took care of U.S. casualties, Vietnamese civilians, D.C., and NVA.
Mm-hmm.
So there were nurses,
mm-hmm.
and it just, it's sort of hard to remember exactly what happened because, I mean, things just got done. We took care of the patients.
And I would guess move them as quickly as you could toward the next care station or whatever they needed next.
Yes.
Okay. Jim, if you don't care to talk about this, that's fine. I wondered if you, though, had any observations on which weapons that were being used in the conflict were inflicting the most damage on the people that you saw in the ER. And what kinds of damage?
I, you know, was not prepared. The destruction on human bodies was what we saw. Because there were guys who, you know, hit mines or booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with multiple amputations. There were burns from white phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
So people come in and the white phosphorus and it was still burning. And you had to neutralize it with, I think, potassium permanganate. The U.S. used, I guess, artillery, which we would call flechettes, basically little arrowheads.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd, somebody come in and you would, you know, they would look like they had minor wounds, and you'd turn them over and you would see that, you know, a whole bunch, part of the body was gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, artillery, shrapnel, it was incredible what, you know, the patient's condition, it was the horror of war. It was very real. And as I said, you know, Parkland, I'd seen, you know, patients with trauma, but it was no preparation for what I saw in Vietnam.
And you had not seen this order of magnitude of injuries up in Quang Tri. Is that fair?
That's correct. Because,
okay.
You know, I was not, even though I was at like Charlie 2, which is, you know, with a bunkered fortification.
Yes.
We basically had very few casualties that came on base. Because if they were out in the field, the medevac choppers picked them up and took them to the 18th Surgical Hospital or the hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would hear about, you know, one of the companies had taken casualties, but I wasn't seeing them. And then when I got to True Life, you know, we were seeing a few casualties. Sometimes it would be a dozen or more.
And they were coming to you this time.
They were coming
right
to the emergency room.
Right.
But I also remember a number of times, you know, there'd be radio connections in the emergency room, and they would say, "Prepare for mass casualty," and so then we'd bring in extra staff, additional. I was a general medical officer of 3,100, so you know we would bring in more people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's several times. You know, we would prepare for a mass casualty. Well, then, you know, a short time later, we'd get, you know, another radio message, you know, like a helicopter accident.
Okay.
Everybody was killed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they weren't coming to you then.
No, they were not coming
right.
to us.
Right.
But there were several times they did. But, and I also did some, like, outpatient, like, medical clinic.
Okay,
uh-huh. So that was part of the time. But predominantly I was working in the emergency room.
And were you on shifts, Jim? Or how was the timing arranged?
It'd be on shifts.
Okay.
And if I was on the night shift and nothing was happening, I'd just go to my hooch. My hooch was very close
mm-hmm.
to the emergency room.
Okay.
And if somebody came in, the medics would just come get me, and I'd get up and go see what was going on.
Okay. Were
or
you?
Or uh-huh. if it was like they were saying, you know, we're expecting a lot of casualties, then they would, you know, get me up, you know, immediately. So
you had to be ready to go, pretty much.
I'd be ready to go.
Jim, can you tell us a little bit about the management of blood typing and blood supplies? How was that handled?
Okay. If someone came in with blood loss, we would, you know, give them a lot of fluids,
mm-hmm.
Try to control, if we could, the source for blood loss. Draw blood for a type and cross match.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would use like O negative or whatever is appropriate.
Right.
You know, it didn't require cross typing. But ideally we did, you know, type and cross matching.
And did were there adequate supplies of blood, and in what form was it? Was there a different protocol and technology than operates now?
No, I think it's probably pretty much the same.
Okay.
That, you know, there were, like, the equipment were used to, you know, force in fluid so rapidly somebody was in shock.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a pressure cuff, and you could put it wrapped around a unit of blood. So it would push it in very rapidly.
Okay.
That was never a problem.
Okay. And you had supplies that were adequate?
They certainly seemed to be. I mean,
okay.
The one, we had a bottleneck in the X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Because first of all, if we had mass casualties, we had a lot of patients. Seeing pictures of the head or abdomen and looking for shrapnel and trying to figure out where it was and whether it required intervention.
Okay.
But the X-ray equipment, the developers, they were automated, but they were getting only like a gallon of water a minute, and as I remember, the requirement was like 5 to 10 gallons of water per minute. So, you know, the company, the hospital commander would get saying, you're ordering too many, you know, to everybody, you're ordering too many X-rays, you have to order what's essential. And so there's a bottleneck there.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, part of it, like, with head injuries, that what the neurosurgeons would do, they were looking to see, you know, with shrapnel, it's very difficult to figure out whether it was, you know, within the skull or not. And they basically took, you know, sterile Q-tips and just probed the area. And if the probe went in, then they knew they had open skull injury, open head injury, and so they'd have to operate.
Okay.
If it was just in the soft tissues, then you know, we could leave it alone. But the same thing was like in the abdomen, was it, you know, did it get through the skin and the muscle into the peritoneal cavity or any organs that were intra-abdominal?
Mm-hmm.
Because that would mean they would have to do, you know, have to operate, do a laparotomy, just exploratory surgery to see what was involved.
Right, looking for shrapnel, I assume.
Well, looking for, you know, was there, you know, doing exploration of the abdominal area to see, you know, what the damage was. Because, I mean, we didn't, you know, this was way before CT was available, so.
Yes.
You know, we were, you know, it was not easy to do. They may have done what was called peritoneal lavage, where they inject, you know, saline solution into the peritoneal cavity and then withdraw it, and if there's blood, there's indication that you have an intraperitoneal wound.
And were there specialist surgeons who handled those cases?
Right, they were general surgeons.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And neurosurgeons like Dr. Stuntz that you mentioned before, they would be assigned what kinds of cases?
Okay, they would do head injuries, or injuries involving, you know, the vertebrospinal cord.
And, Jim, were you making the assessments of this person has a potentially serious back injury or neck injury, needs to see the neurosurgeon? Were you kind of directing traffic like that?
We would be directing traffic that, you know, the, you know, patient, you know, has this,
uh-huh.
and like an head wound.
Right.
So you needed to see the neurosurgeon. But a lot of times the patients would have, you know, burns, they would have fractures, amputations. And so, you know, I think, you know, we'd evaluate what's, you know, stabilized and controlled the bleeding. And then they would go to the OR
uh-huh.
be evaluated, you know, like amputations, completed amputations that was necessary. Or
okay. Jim, were there were field amputations also something that you saw and that you had to then kind of complete the process or move them on to surgery where that process could be completed?
You know, basically, if there was like severe injury to, you know, thigh or leg, then, you know, they'd be evaluated by an orthopedic surgeon, and they would, you know, clean up the wound and, if necessary, complete the amputation.
Okay.
So we were, in emergency, we were not doing that. We were just referring the patient to whoever, the appropriate specialist.
Sure. And Jim, I want to ask you a question about very, very difficult cases. Can you talk a little bit about decisions that are made in a military context that are not made in a civilian context about the very most seriously wounded, in particular if there was a mass cal where treatment might not actually save the man's life?
Right. I mean, that was... I was sent to Canduck for 2 weeks from the 91st back. It was ordered to go there.
Yes.
And we had Fabric got inside the perimeter and had, you know, it was a mass casualty. And
okay.
I was the only physician there. I was with the medics. And you evaluate the casualties and, you know, take care of what needs to be done, and if they're clearly dying and nothing can be done, then, you know, you make that immediate assessment that, you know, there's someone else that you can save, someone else that you can stabilize, and say someone with a very severe head wound. They were clearly dying, and so you know, that was the assessment. They are dying, and you cannot prevent it.
And so what was your decision tree once you had reached that conclusion? What then did you, what was the next step for you? Did you go to a different patient?
Go to a different patient.
Okay.
It's like, you know, you take care of those who will survive. And it certainly is, you know, I know it sounds very cold and calculating, but, you know, you salvage the people who could salvage, and if they couldn't be saved, then you had to make that decision and not get distracted. And, you know, from this point, like, it's just sort of hard, very hard to say that. But when you're in the middle of that situation, it's like, it was like yes or no.
Right.
And that when you put patients in the helicopter for medevac, and they, I think, put like three guys in the center. But the guy at the top, the IVs wouldn't work because of gravity. I mean, there was no differential pressure.
See?
So whoever went on the top was either in pretty good shape and would survive and didn't need IVs, or was dying or dead.
Okay.
So the patient that was on the lowest rack, the IVs would work because there would be like 3 or 4 feet of, you know, differential pressure.
Sure. And was that kind of planning? Did planning go into therefore who would be put in which place in the dust offs? That kind of thinking was behind some of that.
Yes, it was. You know, who has the probability of living, who doesn't, or, you know, who is wounded and, you know, doesn't need, you know, flu right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jim, tell me a little bit about how you came to be TDY up at Comduc.
Well, this is about the 3rd of August. Okay. And I was summoned to the office of the CO for the 91st Evac Hospital, and it was a man named Major Stafford.
Okay.
Who was temporary. I think Colonel Tindler had been there before,
mm-hmm.
and he left. So, you know, we'd already been getting casualties from Camp Duck. I knew it was a bad place.
Was this an SF camp? Or?
It would, well, it had been a special forces camp that was overrun in 1968.
Okay.
And the Maricel Division went back in the summer of 1970. So, you know, we just knew from the urgency, we were getting casualties from there.
Okay, and it was a contested
and
area.
It was, you know, we knew it was a bad place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went to see Major Stafford, and he says, well, we're sending you to Camp Duck. And, you know, I knew I'd already been out in the field, and I said, well, you know, I've already been out in the field. There's some other people here who have not been,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, basically were logical ones. Well, you know, basically, I got a direct order to go. And I said, what if I refuse? And he said, we will court-martial you and send you to the Long Bend Jail.
Okay. Well, that was clear.
So I thought, okay. But so I went back to my hooch, and I wrote a letter, my last letter. Because I thought the chances were I wasn't coming back.
Okay.
And
who did you write the letter to, Jim? Can I ask?
You know, sort of to whom it may concern.
Okay.
You know, mm-hmm. I cursed Colonel Major Stafford. And,
wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, the letter hadn't survived, but, you know, I figured, you know, going there, you know, I could easily get killed.
Right, right. It sounds and, like that's what you expected.
Well, I wouldn't have been surprised.
Right.
And then there was, you know, when I was there, I mean, we got rockets and mortars.
Yeah.
But, you know, when Major Stafford sent me out there, I mean, there was no explanation of sort of the circumstances of this place.
So all you knew about it was what you had kind of picked up from seeing casualties coming through and knowing that it was hot.
Yeah, I knew it was a hot place. But, you know, in retrospect, I mean, like, you know, they sent me out there. I didn't have a steel helmet. I didn't have a flak jacket. And the strange thing is the soldiers out there didn't either.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, really a contrast, because when I've been up along the DMZ at Charlie 2, you know, whenever we were outside, we had to wear flak jackets and steel pops, you know,
right.
helmets. So, you know, what I think is that, you know, the Miracal Division was really slack.
Mm-hmm.
about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, flew out of Chulai probably, I think, the 2nd of August. You know, I think it was like a C-123. And I got photographs I made, you know, looking out over this countryside.
Right.
And there's Chulai, and then here's, you know, the downed railroad bridges that were all over, you know, places I've been that have blown up B.C. Then we turn inland, and, you know, the land is abandoned. They're abandoned glass paddies. and get into the mountains. And suddenly this plane begins to turn, and I look down, and here is this airfield. And the plane made a very steep bank and then dropped. And, you know, when I looked at it, I'm like, oh, shit. Like, you know, where the hell am I? And, you know, it's just before we land, I mean, here's triple canopy jungle that's been defoliated. And I get dumped out, you know, with other people on the flight. And so, you know, I ask, okay, where's the battalion aid station? And so they just tell me where it is, and I walk over there.
And what did you see when you got there?
The battalion aid station was two Connex boxes. One was used for a treatment area. The other Connex box that faced it was where the battalion surgeon lived, where I lived for 2 weeks, and the medical platoon NCO. And then around it was sort of a pathway. It was, you know, in a bunker. The walls were either sandbags or ammo bags, ammo boxes filled with dirt. And it was covered with PSP we did have, you know, a generator, and there was a box with a refrigerated box with blood.
What about tools, supplies, gauze? Did you have all that stuff too?
Well, there were plenty of medical supplies. There was a tent outside of the battalion aid station that had medical supplies.
Okay.
And we had things for doing, like cut downs to start IV.
Right.
And there were some, you know, limited medical supplies. And we had plenty of fluids, gauze, bandages.
And Jim, am I right in thinking from your earlier mention that you were the only medical officer there?
Yes.
What had happened to the... There must have been a guy there earlier. Do you know what happened?
There, yes, there had been a... the previous battalion surgeon... You know, I really don't know which unit it was. Because I was... My order just said I was going TDY with AmeriCal Vision units that were at Camduck. So the... I think the permanent battalion surgeon left. He completed his tour of duty. So when I got there, you know, he'd already gone. Don't remember his name. I don't... And so I was there for 2 weeks until their new battalion surgeon arrived. And then when the battalion surgeon new one arrived, I, you know, showed him around, introduced him to the medics, and then I got the next plane out. Like, I want, you know, out of here.
It sounds like the 2 weeks that you were up there were pretty hairy, as we say.
Well, yeah, they were. But I guess what's always amazed me is how positive people are. I mean, you know, we were in the middle of this horrible place. But, I mean, it was just people are very... I just thought the guys were amazingly positive. But, you know, like when I mean, there was very little communal memory where I was in Vietnam about what had happened.
Right.
But you've landed at Camduck, and here's the wreckage of, I think, C-130s. You know, the fuselage of these planes that had pushed right off the runway.
Yeah.
There was probably a fuselage, maybe one, at least one helicopter. And so the communal memory was, this had been a special forces camp. It was had been overrun a few years before. But it's like, that was sort of all the memory there was.
And, Jim, if you can you describe the time up there at Kamduk when the perimeter was breached by the enemy? Was it VC or NVA, or could you tell?
From what I've read lately, it's probably NVA.
Okay.
We were, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was going right toward this place. But, I mean, we got rockets and mortars all the time.
At night? Or all the time?
Not day.
Okay.
So, you know, we would get rockets or mortars. They would call in airstrikes, either in helicopter gunships or, fighter planes. And some of them, they drop. I've got photographs of, bombs hitting in the area. And, the rockets or mortars would stop for a while. And then, we keep saying, well, Charlie, lob one in again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, nah.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw them. We never saw them. But I think, from what I've discovered, maybe last year, probably around the 5th or 6th of August, there was a sapper attack. They got inside the perimeter.
Okay.
And the sappers came in between where, the AmeriCal infantry units were, and I think the artillery.
Yeah.
It was a valley. It's a small valley.
Okay.
So we had nice casualties. It was sometime in the middle of the night. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Because, I don't remember what happened. I just remember I was taking care of all of these patients. And I realized we had the lights on, and that was not good because we could be seen. But it's like, that sort of, it's just really bizarre. Being in an altered state of consciousness, that I was taking care of patients, I was doing what I was supposed to do, and I was not aware of, the noise of what was happening. And I'm sure there was noise. But when it was all over, later that morning, I was incredibly shaky because, we could have been killed. Not
mm-hmm.
just me, but many of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very rough.
Jim, did you in some way, I'm just trying to understand, go into kind of autopilot or some kind of automatic where you were just doing as much as you could, as fast as you could, without really thinking too much?
It's autopilot or an altered state of consciousness. I mean, you do what you're supposed to do.
Okay.
And it's probably what happens to people in combat. You do what you're supposed to do, you're trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I knew the situation was bad, but I was doing what I was trained to do. So, just like there was no awareness of part of what was going on. Until it was all over, and I thought, I can't believe being killed. I mean, we all did.
Were there helicopters coming in and out to take some of the wounded to more expanded facilities elsewhere? Do you remember that?
The helicopters, as I remember, didn't come in until daylight.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because of where we were, they could not fly at night. He
sure.
couldn't see where we were. I mean, there was it was by direct sight only. either for the public C-123s or the helicopters.
Right.
So we had no nighttime flights. And we frequently had fog. And from what I've read lately, I mean, Camp Duck has some of the worst visibility in any place in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like one mountain, was like, I think it's like 5 or 6 thousand feet, I'm not real sure. But I mean, it was an obstacle to flying. So, you know, it's like, and I, you know, was very aware that, you know, each morning it's like the fog got worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's ground fog, and you couldn't see.
Jim, do you remember flying out of there?
Yes.
Can you describe what happened that day, the day you left there?
It was like the new surgeon came in, battalion surgeon. I oriented him, and I walked over to where the flights took off, and I left. But, you know, there had been, apparently there was some contact I was having with my friend. You know, I could send, like, notes back to the 91st Evac Hospital because a number of times I requested film.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Or clothes, or things like that.
Things that you needed, uh-huh.
Right. So my friends were sending stuff, and I've got, probably took several black and white rolls of film and color slides.
Just as an aside, have you sent those yet?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I will in time, but like emotionally, those are the ones that are like the hardest to let go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the best photographs I took because of the immediacy. You know, I've got portraits of the medics. There's like two photographs of a mortar crew. One of them, they're getting ready to fire a mortar. And then the next one, you know, they yelled hang fire, I think is what they said. And, you know, the mortar went off and I jumped. So the second one of them, you know, is blurred because I jumped from, you know, the loud sound of the mortar going off.
Sure.
And sometime during that, I was there, an officer came to the aid station and said that a squad of men was coming in, and that he said, take care of their medical needs, but do not ask where they have been. And, you know, the situation was, I didn't know where we were, other than someplace out in the boonies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I had asked any of the men where they were, oh, they said, oh, we were, you know, 5 or 6 kilometers out on hill 243, which, you know, meant absolutely nothing to me.
Right.
But when this officer said, don't ask where they had been, I knew they'd been in Laos, where we officially didn't have a presence.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And I've got, I took two photographs of men from the squad. One was a lieutenant, and one was a member of another member of the squad. And they have what's called the 1,000-yard stare, which is like chronic fatigue, hypervigilance, you know, looking into eternity. It's sort of a look of, that I've also seen on people who are dying. I mean, these guys are certainly not dying, but, you know, it's just this very unusual look.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, you know, if it had been known that I took these photographs, they would have not been happy with me and probably confiscated the film.
Did anything like that ever happen?
No. But you know, the thing is, I didn't know who these people were.
Sure. Right.
And it was only like last year when I was reading about, you know, what this, they were. It was the, you know, Surveillance and Observation Group. But I just knew that, you know, it was a squad that had been out in Laos.
Mm-hmm. Was it fairly well known, although officially not acknowledged, that American troops were across the border? It seems as if you knew that.
Well, you know, actually, I didn't know that.
Okay.
But, you know, as I said, when this officer said, don't ask, you know, I knew, you know, actually, all he had to do was just stay there with them. And if I asked him improper, he could have said, you can't ask that. But, you know, he really blew their cover.
Right. By upfront telling you.
So. Yeah, because, you know, I took care of guys who'd been out in the jungle all the time. And, you know, as I said, you know, I mean, they could have told me anything, and I wouldn't have known anything. I mean, it wouldn't have made any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, wasn't particularly curious about where they had been.
Right.
Because, I mean, where we, the, like, I don't remember, like, in the medical platoon, we had maps. You know, to say where we were.
Right, and keeping track of where a particular injury had been sustained was not part of what you were doing.
Exactly.
Right.
But I just knew that, you know, where we were, I mean, it was very, it was beautiful. There were high mountains around it. There was a pretty long runway. But, you know, it was just a very scary place to be. You know, when you showed me that 3D map of Diem Bien Phu,
yes,
it was like looking at Canduck.
In what way, Jim?
In the sense of, you know, being surrounded by high, you know, ridges or mountains. In an isolated area at the end of a supply line, you know, with no connection by land.
You were dependent completely on air resupply.
On air resupply, and only when the visibility was good.
Right.
And also knowing that Canduck had been overrun previously. Because, I mean, all you had to do was look around, and here is the evidence of it.
Jim, let's take a break for a minute.
Sure.
Jim, go ahead and tell me about Harold Gay.
Okay. Harold was a medic with the medevac crew. They flew in and out of Canduck. I think a lot of times, I mean, they were actually, they stayed there overnight. In bunkers right by the aid station. The medevac helicopter was parked right by the aid station.
Okay.
And I visited with Harold. He was sort of this very gentle person. I mean, he was like very dedicated about what he was doing. And just sort of a very powerful sense of balance. And, you know, I thought he was actually older than he turned out to be. And so, you know, he asked me to take a photograph of him because he knew I was interested in photography and was developing, you know, the pictures. So I did a portrait of him inside, I saw the porch of the battalion aid station.
Okay, this is in Canduck.
In Canduck, correct. So, when I got back to Tulane, I developed it, printed it, and then mailed it to him. But he was killed in, I think, the 20th of October when two helicopters collided. And I think, I got the photograph back with a, I know I got it back probably in Albuquerque.
Okay. So after you were out
after
of country.
After I got, was transferred back to the U.S.
Yeah.
And with a letter from the U.S. Army saying, unfortunately we were not able to deliver this because Harold Gay was killed on, 20th of October. Well, I knew that because I had signed his death certificate.
You had?
Yes. With, other members of these two helicopter crews. And, what I wanted to do was, to get the portrait back to his family, but I didn't know, I didn't have any information about where he, I thought he was in Georgia, actually he was in North Carolina.
Okay.
But, I didn't have, I didn't know the names of his family, I didn't know how to contact them. And then, a few weeks, I guess about 2 months ago, through Bob Brockington, who is an investigator evaluating what happened to those at collision of the two helicopters. I got in contact with Harold's brother. I visited with him by phone. And then I gave the portrait to Harold's niece, who then carried it by hand back to North Carolina. So, it felt very good completing the circle that I got the portrait of Harold back to his family. And there were some other photographs, a few others that I had of him that I've also sent to his family, that it was, it's part of healing, but it's like, this is what I could do for Harold. When he came in with the rest of the crew, they were all, none were alive.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't know why they were brought in the sense that from what Bob Brockington has told me that, that was very clear out in the field. But, it just feels, I feel complete, about, what I could do for Harold. I couldn't do anything medically.
Right.
But I could, return this gift of him back to the family.
And, Jim, just to clarify, you had kept the photograph all of this time.
I kept the photograph all this time. And it was, it was folded, and plus I had the letter that came from the Army.
Really? And did you send that along to his brother as well?
Right. I gave the original photograph plus the original letter and a better print that hadn't been folded.
I know this is very, this must have been a very personal exchange between you and his brother, but can you just give us the tenor of your conversation?
His brother's name is Ron Gay, who'd been in the Marines, and it was sort of like talking to Harold, and since a very gentle man and someone who was very balanced. I mean, he was very appreciative of getting the photograph. And sort of beginning to learn more of what happened to Harold, you know, people who might have known him. And that it was just, it was a very powerful sense of connection.
And I think, Jim, a really wonderful thing that you did, you were, you know, conscientious enough to have kept this material so that when the opportunity came, you could do something for that family.
Right. I mean, I didn't expect it to happen.
No, I'm sure you didn't.
And it's what I always wanted. And it was, there was this frustration, like, I don't know how to connect. And, you know, it's one thing that's happened with the Internet, that we can connect sometimes very rapidly. But it did feel very good, and I did meet Harold's niece, who actually lives in Fort Worth.
So that's strange.
Yeah, and actually, Harold also has a first cousin that I have not visited with. I told Ron Gaze I'd be glad to talk to the cousin. Who worked at Parkland Hospital as a counselor.
No kidding. That's incredible.
Right.
That's really incredible. Jim, can I ask you a little bit more about Chulai?
Sure.
You mentioned earlier that there were Vietnamese interpreters around and that you did see coming through the ER civilians as well as combatant Vietnamese.
Yes.
Did treating VC and NVA combatants bring up any kind of special issues or feelings either for you or for other personnel?
Well, like, you know, we took care of them. But like for the VC or NVA, what we knew was that, you know, we might salvage them and save their lives, but then they'd be transferred to the South Vietnamese care, and they would probably be killed.
Now, what do you mean they would be killed?
Well, I mean, the feeling was that the South Vietnamese wouldn't take care of them.
Okay.
They would torture them. They would, I'm not sure how true this was.
Sure.
The feeling was that we were perhaps wasting our time.
Okay.
Because that once they got transferred over, that they might not be very well off.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was a general kind of feeling or understanding that was pretty current among American medical personnel.
Yeah.
Okay. Were the enemy combatants segregated on the wards at all from American personnel?
They had be on their own wards, and I think there were guards around them. But, you know, if they had major wounds, I mean, like, you know, requiring amputation or anything like that, I mean, they were treated like the U.S. servicemen.
Okay. Did you spend any time on the wards at all? Walking around or visiting with people or just kind of taking in what was happening there?
I remember going, sometimes we get called the wards because there would be some type of, medical need be taken care of, or
sure.
I'd be seeing someone who'd been wounded. My main involvement was in the emergency room or in, like, an outpatient clinic.
Okay. Can you tell me anything about the management of particular kinds of cases once they had passed out of the Chulai, the 91st Evac care to other hospitals? How was it determined who, for example, would be evac'd to Japan or back to the States or to other hospitals? Can you shed any light on that?
Once the patients were stabilized,
mm-hmm.
Then we would transfer them with a medical attendant from Chulai to Da Nang, and then that'd be by helicopter.
Okay.
And I think there were some, you know, so-called walking wounded that would be transferred by helicopter but didn't require a medical attendant. But, I mean, they couldn't be returned to duty.
Okay.
At least immediately. So they might be, you know, also be on the, you know, the jet that flew to Yokota.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we transferred them, like, to Tachikawa. I've actually got, you know, accompanied patients on two occasions to Japan. You know, I've got the orders that, you know, list who they were and their units.
Okay, and can you tell me about the circumstances of those trips? Was the reason that you went because they were in a particular condition, or how did that come about?
Those are required, you know, severely wounded and required continuing medical care.
Okay.
Then physicians would fly with them by helicopter to Da Nang, and then we were on a military jet, like military equivalent, like a 707. And, you know, if they needed pain medication, if they needed additional IVs during the trip,
right?
We monitored the vital signs and so sort of whatever their needs were. And then once we got them to Yokota, then I think there were like helicopter flights to Tachikawa or whichever military facility they were going to.
Okay.
And that once we delivered them, you know, we'd have their chart with them, and then we would transfer them and, you know, turn over the medical care to people in the hospital.
Okay. And on the occasions when you made this trip, did you stay in Japan, or did you turn right around and come right back to Vietnam?
Well, theoretically, we were supposed to return immediately.
Yes.
But, you know, usually if you worked it right, you spent several days in around Tokyo.
How would it be done that you would work it?
Well, the first time I went, you know, I was in Tokyo for several days and got back. But, you know, I didn't have any particular problems, but I think the other guys and myself, you know, we were getting, like, just supposed to turn around immediately. Well, it was, you know, a fairly grueling, long flight to go there and to turn around immediately. And, like, the second time I went, I thought, you know, I've been in the military long enough to play the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, I've got the notes of who I contacted and, you know, why they couldn't get me on a flight.
Really? Okay.
So it's like, okay.
Yep.
This is military, you know, I'm going to play with this system too.
Okay.
I want to enjoy some time in Tokyo. And the second time I went, it was like, I stayed at the Sanno Hotel, which is a military hotel in downtown Tokyo. And the second time I went, it was this, you know, it to me is like, it was this bizarre situation because it was, they were doing Oktoberfest.
Okay.
At a military hotel in Tokyo, and they had a German oompa band, except they were all Japanese.
Okay, that sounds strange.
Well, Vietnam was this strange, surreal situation where it's the movie Apocalypse Now really is what it's about in the sense of surreal. A UFO show and going out in the bush within a few hours and killing, or whatever it is.
Right.
And then, I mean, it's crazy. And that, you know, this, you know, a Japanese oompa band at a military hotel in Tokyo, you know, is all, you know, it's part of the craziness.
Yeah. Did you think to bring your camera along on these trips?
I did take my camera on both trips.
Okay. And were you able to use it as you had time during the days that you were there?
I took photographs, but actually don't have them anymore. I threw them away.
Okay. You threw them away.
Well, I've got thousands of slides.
I know.
And it was like, okay, I've got to start cleaning some stuff out. But,
okay.
I mean, there were, you know, it's like Tokyo. And, like, I guess one I really wish I'd kept was a close-up of the advertisement for MASH with Japanese characters.
This would be for the film?
For the film MASH.
Uh-huh.
Showing in Tokyo.
Yeah. Jim, how did that strike you? Seeing that advertisement.
Well, it's part of this craziness, and you know, it's like I was living in MASH, in boys' camp in July. That you know, we had our rituals. We had a flag that we lowered whenever anybody left, and their honor. We had farewell parties. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And whenever, when I was in July, whenever the career military went someplace and went by, I mean, we'd yell "Liver" at them.
You yelled what?
Liver.
Really?
And the Livers didn't come to boys' camp.
Uh-huh.
They weren't welcome.
Okay.
They only... Well, let's see. Colonel Tindler was very well liked and respected by the men at the, you know, doctor's position, dentist. So I mean, he came to the boys' camp. But basically, like Major Stafford,
yeah,
he never came to the boys' camp.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have been welcome.
Now, what set apart the officers, the career military guys, who you could have over to boys' camp and those who you couldn't. Can you clarify that a little?
Well, I think, like with Colonel Tindler, I mean, he was conveyed a sense of warmth and interest in us. But, you know, so, I mean, he was certainly personally welcome. But I think we also felt like he betrayed us in one way because his son was like an enlisted man or medic, I think was in Vietnam. Colonel Tindler got him out of Vietnam. And then, but quickly, Colonel Tindler left the 91st AVAC. And the rumor was it was sort of like a, you know, he'd played the system with a trumped up medical situation.
Okay.
And so he got, you know, a medical transfer himself out of Vietnam.
And did he, was this a rumor, or was it something that you thought probably had some backing to it?
It was a rumor, but I mean, he suddenly, you know, he got his son out, and he was gone.
Yeah. Did he fall, then, in the estimation of the guys there at boys' camp?
Well, he was sort of like, you know, he'd played the system, and we sort of wish we could play the system like that, too. But it's like, okay, you know, he got out, but we can't.
Right. Let me ask you a little bit, Jim, about the relationship between the doctors and the nurses at Chulai. Can you comment on that?
They were actually very good.
Mm-hmm.
The nurses were highly professional, competent, motivated. They, in terms of mass casualties, they knew what to do, how to handle patients, with triage, with paperwork, with whatever needed to be done, it was very much a team effort. We all worked very well as a team. That, basically, we all got along really well.
Mm-hmm. Were there off-duty tensions or maybe very harmonious liaisons as well that you knew about?
There was one of the physicians having an affair with one of the nurses. But it was like, whatever happens after hours happens after hours.
Okay, right.
It was not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nurses was named Lily, who was African American.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the only African American woman at 91st and back.
Right.
And the African American men, I think, probably just, they were very attracted to her. She was a good looking woman.
Sure.
And, she didn't want all the attention she was getting.
Uh-huh.
She was always very professional about it. But, I tend to remember that some of the guys were saying, where's Lieutenant Lily? We want to see her. Like, this is an emergency room. We can't handle your request. Sorry.
That was kind of a smooth way to handle that, though.
Yeah. But she was a good-looking woman, and they were attracted to her, and it was understandable.
Mm-hmm. Was it apparent then that guys kind of, some African-American guys anyways, had heard that there was an African-American woman working at Chulai, and they just knew about it somehow?
Well, first of all, if they came in through the emergency room, a lot of them had seen her.
Oh, okay, because she was working in the ER?
She worked in the emergency room.
I see.
A photograph of her in the emergency room.
Okay,
but I'm sure, through the grapevine they were passing around, there is this good-looking chick in the emergency room.
Right, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Where was she from, do you know?
I really don't know.
Okay.
There was a captain who worked in the emergency room who was career Army.
Yeah.
And she was really hard.
Okay.
Just harsh.
Okay.
And I remember there was one of the nurses who was, her boyfriend was, I think it was like a helicopter pilot, and he was killed in a helicopter crash.
Mm-hmm.
And she was distraught, so I gave her a profile, basically so she'd have like a day to recover.
Right.
And I think wrote down grief reaction. And, this captain nurse is like, she was really irritated because, she is a nurse in the Army. She's not entitled to grief.
Wow. Did she say something similar to that to you?
Yes. She jumped me.
Wow.
She'll be capable of coming to duty. I don't care. Her boyfriend was killed.
Wow. What did you do, Jim?
Well, I didn't change it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because, this...
That was your assessment.
Retrospectively, I should have given her some other diagnosis, like bad cold.
I see. Okay.
Sore throat. I shouldn't have done anything quite so revealing.
I see.
Uh-huh. I should have played the system better.
Hmm.
But I was naive. And but, you know, she clearly wasn't capable of functioning. I mean, she needed some time to recover.
Jim, can you tell me anything about the relationships between the medical personnel there at Chulai and the dust-off pilots? We've alluded to them a number of different times, and actually not just the pilots, but the crew members as well. Did you spend much time with them? I know that you had up at Comduk, but I'm wondering about just day-to-day at the 91st EVAC.
No, because, you know, they would, the dust-off crews would come in, they would unload patients, and then they were gone.
Okay.
Because they were supposed to keep the landing pad clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, you know, where they went. I mean, I assume it's a place on the Chulai base, which was sprawling. You know, I really didn't have any, you know, ways of getting around the base to really see how far it went, but it was a, you know, it was a large place. So I'm not sure where the helicopter crews went. But I think they were at Chulai because Da Nang was too far away.
Mm-hmm.
They needed to be there, you know, so they could get access to where the Mirakel division was going.
And so you weren't really in any way able to kind of, you know, get any kind of relationship going with those guys?
No, because I mean, they were in, they were out.
Okay. Did you see the same crews with regularity? Did you see them?
The thing is, I really don't know because, you know, they would bring the patients in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we were having patients coming in, then we didn't need to be out on the landing pad.
Okay.
And so the medics and or the Vietnamese workers would take the patients off the out of the helicopter and bring them into the emergency room. You know, I did take a few pictures of, you know, these helicopters unloading patients when I was not on duty.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as all the patients were off, they were gone.
Jim, let me ask you a little bit about our allies in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have an occasion to treat or to come across in some other capacity Australian or New Zealand troops or Korean troops?
No.
Okay. But you did have occasion, am I right, in thinking that you saw ARVN troops?
Correct.
Okay. Were they brought into the 91st EVAC in the same way that American troops were?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did you form any kind of opinion or general observations about the ARVN forces or their organization or their medical establishment that backed them up?
I guess the main observations I had were when I was at Canduck.
Okay.
Because it was like a joint operation between Mirakel Division and the ARVN.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, before, you know, like they would have an air assault by helicopter from Camduck. And we would get ARVNs coming in who had deliberately either shot toes off or kicked bomblets. They were little tiny bombs that you kick them and they could blow toes off. That, you know, they would deliberately do it so they wouldn't have to go out in the field.
So you were seeing self-inflicted wounds?
We were seeing self-inflicted wounds.
And it was clear to you that the rationale behind this action was avoidance of duty?
Yes.
Okay.
And I remember once, you know, the guy, you know, ARVN had blown off some toes, and we bandaged him up, and, you know, he was getting ready for a medevac, and I think through his translator, you know, it turned out he was very unhappy. He was going to be sent to Chulai, that he wanted to go to Da Nang. Because the thing is, Chulai, you know, he couldn't disappear. If he went to the Da Nang, he could disappear in the civilian population.
And he couldn't at Chulai because why?
Chulai was isolated.
Okay.
I guess what I read, you know, like last year was, basically there was nothing at Chulai. And actually, Chulai is not a Vietnamese word.
Mm-hmm.
Admiral Krulak or something like that. And that, you know, through misinterpretation, it became Chulai. You know, I didn't know that when I was there. I just thought it was a Vietnamese word.
Right.
But apparently, it wasn't. But, I mean, there was, you know, from, like, the helicopter, or the C-123 flight to Camp Duck, I mean, there was nothing around it. And the time, like, the photos I took when I accompanied patients on one of the flights from Chulai to Da Nang, it's like the area was pretty well abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, from Chulai north to Da Nang, I mean, there was not a lot of evidence for agriculture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was sort of amazing to look like, you know, there's nobody here.
So for this Arvin soldier, it was a bad destination given his plans.
Yeah, it was given his, you know, he wanted to, yeah, my interpretation was that he wanted to go to Da Nang because he could disappear at Da Nang.
Uh-huh.
But going to Chulai, you know, he might have trouble getting off base.
Was there any discussion or chat, you know, out on the veranda at boys' camp about this kind of apparent misconduct on the part of the ally that we were supposedly there to support?
It was very disdainful.
Really?
I'm not sure how much, you know, direct contact there had been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say with the medical specialist, they hadn't been out in the field.
Right.
So, you know, they didn't really have any direct contact in that sense.
Did you guys sitting out there in the evenings talk about the politics behind U.S. involvement? Or more broadly, U.S. That is inside the United States reactions to what was happening in Vietnam.
I think it was just, you know, lamenting the stupidity of being there.
Okay.
And but a lot of it was just this longing for when we get back in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, to me, that was a term we used, the world.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, also connects with this sort of surreal feeling that we weren't on this planet. That, you know, when we get back, you know, from outer space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just so bizarre.
Yeah. Speaking of that, it reminds me of something that you wrote in the materials that you gave us about a USO show that you attended where one of the performers changed the words to a song. Do you remember that?
Actually, it was a nurse.
Okay. Okay.
And
I'm sorry.
I think it may have been. I think it was Lou or Louise Grawl, not G-R-A-U-L.
Okay.
But is like, this land's not my land, this land's not your land, this land's not my land from the central highlands, the coastal lowlands, this land's not meant for you, this land's not meant for me.
That sounds very much like a protest.
Yeah.
Is that how you heard it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think she recorded it, you know, like on a cassette player.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. She was playing a, you know, guitar.
Okay.
But, you know, it was just like, the feeling was, you know, with like physicians and dentists, like, you know, they may have our body, but they don't have our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were voluble in the sense of protesting because the, you know, Boy Scouts had a song. It only had one word, and that word was fuck.
Okay.
Sung louder and louder and louder. And particularly when lifers went by. So, you know, I'm sure they were very aware of, you know, how we felt.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it also, you know, I really felt some of this very strong commitment that we were going to do professionally what needed to be done.
Right, for the patients who were coming in.
Mm-hmm. For the patients.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they didn't own our minds. And, you know, we were going to, you know, they got to hear, I mean, they knew how far they could go.
Yeah, there was, from their point of view, an attitude problem.
Yeah, we had an attitude problem.
Right.
But I think what they did was they took it in balance was we were doing professionally what we were supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
That, you know, they just didn't, you know, get involved in it.
Mm-hmm. They let it go.
They let it go.
Yeah.
That, you know, I'm not sure, you know. They were, you know, I think accomplishing the mission they had. So they just accepted this other aspect. But the thing is, we were not around FIGON. We were not around, you know, spit and polish attitude.
Mm-hmm.
That existed from what I heard from, like, Bill Elkins, a friend of mine, who had been in Pleiku, and then he was at part of the Third Field Hospital. So it was a very different situation.
How was it different? I mean, can you characterize that?
You know, they weren't concerned about, we had to wear uniforms, but, you know, we didn't have to wear starched jungle fatigues.
Right.
So, but in Saigon, you had to wear starched jungle fatigues. And, you know, spit polished boots, and ours were, you know, I still got my boots, and they were definitely scruffy after a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wasn't, you know, nobody was, we didn't have to stand inspection in uniforms. We had to wear them.
But that kind of detail wasn't an overriding concern.
No, but mm-hmm. I think it's also just a reflection of where I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in central facilities where there was a big, you know, command presence.
Right, right.
And like at the hospital, you know, we had very little connection or interaction with the command staff with the Miracal Division. You know, sometimes we would go over there to the officers' club, but it was just a drink, and we weren't, I don't remember ever meeting general over there, or, you know, it's like the officers from the hospital would go to, they would have like a luau.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the officers' club, like, you know, had this thatched roof. It was, like, it was very nice.
It was kind of a different feeling.
Yeah, it was a different feeling.
Yeah.
But we also had, I mean, there was an officer's club at the 91st Attack Hospital.
And did you spend much time over there, Jim, at the officer's club at the 91st?
I didn't spend that. Well, I'd go there occasionally. I just, alcohol never did very much for me. It always made me sick. So
that wasn't your scene, really.
Yeah. It was very easy not to drink very much because I couldn't.
Okay.
But I know a lot of the other, physicians, they were drinking a lot. Because it was readily available. I mean, you could go to the PX and get, at least the officers could get, you'd buy fists of booze, of good stuff, for, $2.
Right. Did it ever become a problem, do you think, for some of the guys, some of the physicians?
Some of them got pretty drunk at night.
Yeah.
But, I don't really think it affected function at Leech's and all that evidence.
Yeah. Jim, I want to ask you a little bit about your downtime and other ways that you might have spent it. Did you do much reading or writing of letters?
I wrote letters. Did I get some reading? And when I was at Quantry, I went to the photographic lab a lot.
Right.
The one at Chulai was, I'm guessing, maybe half mile or more away. So I'd have to walk there and back.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not that accessible.
Go ahead.
And I could visit, where my hooch was right by Boys Camp Deck. So there were, people out there all the time.
Okay. Did you have recording equipment, like cassette recorders, that you were either playing cassettes on or making cassettes and sending them to people?
No.
Okay.
I had cassette players, and I just had recorded music.
Okay. I was going to ask you a little bit about music. Are there certain songs or groups whose music still resonates for you as part of that time over there?
Like music from, I think, Thomas Crown Affair.
Okay.
And it was like there's stuff on AFDN.
Mm-hmm.
My interest was always like in classical music, so Armed Forces Network they weren't playing my music.
No, they weren't playing much of that.
So I did have some cassettes that I got that I listened to.
Did it play a role for you, having some of your own music to listen to?
Well, I think it did. But I lost a lot of that when my luggage was stolen.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a bad experience.
Well, yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I had saved my film equipment. I'd already mailed them back to the U.S.
Now, where were you mailing them?
To my folks.
Okay. And what were they doing? Did you give them instructions as to what you wanted to have happen? Just put them in a room and leave them alone, or did they just take the packages and just wait until you got home with it?
I think most of them I had processed by Kodak.
Okay.
And then I think my father would mail some back to Vietnam, but then I would mail them back. The processing by the Vietnamese is frequently not very good.
Mm-hmm.
Dirty chemicals or just not very good.
Okay.
So I learned quickly not to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, I did it more than perhaps realized at the time. But, and then I would send some photographs to my folks. And, like, when I was in Canada, you know, I sent them some photographs. And I don't remember there was any particular reaction.
So these are your prints?
These are my prints.
Okay, uh-huh. They didn't comment?
No.
So that's sort of in keeping with what you had said earlier about their...
But what I said about my folks is, I mean, they lived life on stage. They were actors, you know, who faked life. So, you know, what's part of the... Okay, let's just pretend everything's okay, and Jim's just, you know, away on vacation.
That's pretty hollow feeling.
Yeah, but it was always a very difficult situation to figure out because they always pretended like we were a perfect family, when in fact, you know, we were clearly not a perfect family.
Right.
Because my father was gay.
Okay.
But, yeah.
But not out? I'm taking it at all? Is that right?
Well, the thing is, I knew his lover. You know, this is my interpretation of the facts.
Okay.
And my mother hated this guy's guts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, but it's like, well, let's pretend this isn't the situation.
Yeah. Wow, that's complex.
Yeah. But it was like, you know, with this perfect family... But, you know, there's this man that my father is seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my mother hated his guts.
And was this relationship going on for a long time? Was it a long-term thing?
My father... came to Fort Worth in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get married until 1942.
Okay.
And the man's name was John Potts. He was a physician.
Okay.
In Fort Worth, he specialized in tuberculosis. And mother and dad went together for a very long time before they ever got married.
Right.
And they basically didn't get married until my mother said, if we don't get married, I'm going to Washington, D.C. and find myself a man.
So your dad kind of got leveraged into marrying her in some way?
Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, the friendship continued.
Uh-huh. So that was always a source of probably a very intense... stuff between your mom and your dad.
Well, it was never, you know.
It sublimated, though, right?
All this stuff was below the surface. I mean, it was like,
yeah.
I mean, there was just so much stuff that was not talked about.
Yeah.
And that was just one of the things that was not talked about.
And another of those things was your, you know, what you were actually doing in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of all on the same scale.
Yeah, it's like, let's just pretend.
Wow.
That everything is okay. And, you know, it's sort of protective, but it's like, I've got the letters, and I'm just like, you know, my feeling is they were probably in Texas Tech soon, because I'm not exactly... anxious to look at them.
I see.
I mean, you know,
I'm sure.
I've sampled them,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, you know, just this indifference. But in some ways, my folks were very supportive. I mean, I did get lots of letters. They sent lots of care packages. They sent cookies and crackers, and, you know, pizza mix, gushers. When I was in Quantry, they sent a plastic Christmas tree.
So it was complicated.
Oh, it was complicated.
Yeah. Yeah, people are like that.
Yeah, it was. So, you know, one level, you know, they were very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
But it was certainly not at an emotional level.
And I, you know, I don't want to press too hard on this, Jim,
sure.
But I hear from you that was something you could have used while you were over there, with some kind of emotional support.
Well, I could have used emotional support, but the thing is, I was not open about my sexuality either. So, you know, I didn't have that type of support.
Okay.
So I was pretending to be somebody that I wasn't.
Right.
And, you know, some of the letters are with a woman that I dated for a while, quite a few years. So, you know, I realized I was, you know, very lonely, very much in need of support. One of the people I remember very fondly, and I finally reestablished connection with her, was Cherie Hawes, who was a nurse at 94th Street Back.
And how do you spell her last name?
H-A-W-E-S.
Okay. And that's Cherie.
Cherie.
Uh-huh.
C-H-E-R-I. And, you know, that, you know, she was a nurse who worked in the emergency room. But, you know, we'd certainly developed a very supportive friendship.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we laughed. We talked about what's going to happen in the future. But, you know, it was also professional. But just like, you know, it was a nurturing. And, you know, it's, you know, looking back, like, I mean, she was probably the person I was closest to. Who was in the middle of all of that.
Where was she from? Where is she from?
I think like the Middle West.
And you've been in contact with her again, is that right, Jim?
Yes.
Okay.
Compliments of Nanny Fortin.
Right. She puts a lot of people together.
Right. And
yeah.
So we visited probably like an hour. It was like several weeks ago. And then I subsequently sent her, you know, two packages of photographs from 91st Back Hospital. She's returned a letter with information. But right now she's in the process of moving from Greenwich, Connecticut to Arizona.
Okay.
So, I mean, she's sort of out of pocket.
Right. What was it like to speak with her again? As someone that you were fairly close to over there and considered a friend, I take it.
Right.
Yeah.
It was, but like we had not been, you know, last time I had talked to her, like when I left in 1970.
Sure, right.
And then we'd exchanged some letters in the 71, and then, you know, the contact had ended, and it's like, I mean, part of my situation, like, not wanting to be reminded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's like, you know, she answers the phone, and it's like, I don't know what kind of voice to expect. And, but, you know, very quickly, you know, it got, you know, it's like, went to talking for over an hour.
Mm-hmm.
There was, but it wasn't just about the past, like, you know, what, you know, has happened to us since then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she talked about, you know, relationships, and she talked about her son, and I realized I was not completely completely forthcoming about myself, and so, you know, I sent her, you know, a letter with the first batch of photographs saying, you know, let me back up about my personal relationships. I'm gay, and I came out in 1980, had some information about my lover, and, you know, I think she was very appreciative of the fact that I was open about who I am and my circumstances. And, you know, actually, you know, I don't know, maybe the relief that, you know, I was not trying to create a love interest or something like that.
Right.
I mean, we didn't really go into that, but I think, you know, that actually may have made things better, that clearly, you know, this is who I am, this is who she is, and that, you know, but also by phone, and then also in the letter, just expressed appreciation for her.
Yes, and it's based on an authentic sort of relationship that you had had, you know, or pieces of authenticity that you had had in Vietnam, and and kind of carrying that through to the present.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm sure that she was, you know, probably very happy that, you know, for your happiness and for your honesty as well.
Right, and I thought, you know, I realized, you know, I've got to, it's very important that I do this. Both for her and for me. That, you know, this is who I am, this is where I'm coming from.
Jim, thinking back on your time in Vietnam, did were there gay relationships that you saw or knew about or on some level recognized?
No, because I was very much in the closet. I was terrified of being discovered.
Sure, of course.
And so, like, when I was in Hong Kong, you know, I had sex with some prostitutes.
Okay.
Trying to produce, you know, prove that I was straight, but, well, it didn't work.
Just proving it to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
you
know, like, no, okay.
Right.
I knew that, but I tried to, you know, have sex with a woman, and, okay, that's not who I am.
Right.
So, you know, there was that. There were a few times with patients who I think were being seductive.
Okay.
And I just, you know, stayed, you know, there may have been an attraction, but, like, there's no way I was going there.
You couldn't act on it at all.
I wasn't going to act on it.
Yeah.
And I just, you know,
just
I felt what was going on. But I also realized, nope, I am not going there. It's not appropriate, and, you know, they were sort of baffled about the way I reacted, because I'm sure they thought that I knew that I was gay.
Right.
But I wasn't reacting, you know, to what I think was, you know, probably a seduction.
Okay.
In the guise of, you know, patient coming in to see the doctor.
Right.
So that was difficult. There was one of the physicians at the 91st back hospital who, you know, accused me of being gay. But, I mean, he was doing that to other people, too. And, you know, looking back, he probably was. It was just a way of protecting himself by accusing other people.
And what was you talked about the motivation for that, but under what circumstances did he come to you privately and say?
No, I mean, it was, you know, people would be around, but I mean, he was just, you know, I was queer or somebody else was.
Okay. Yeah.
And you know, it was coming out, you know, frequently enough that, you know, I didn't like being around him.
Right. For sure.
I mean, he was, you know, someone I had characterized as sort of the Winchester of our group.
That's a reference to the television show?
Uh-huh. Yes, because, I mean, he with wore half glasses and was always peering over his half glasses, like, you know, over a lorgnette.
Uh-huh. With a kind of authority thing going.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Attitude. Major.
But he was kind of casting aspersions on other people as well?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of stayed clear?
Yeah, I didn't like him.
Yeah.
I you know, even without that, I didn't particularly care for him. So,
sure.
You know, because, you know, he was Winchester. You know, I mean, that's only sort of a current,
mm-hmm.
you know, view, but that's sort of, you know, how he came across.
Mm-hmm. Jim, as you were coming closer to the end of your year-long rotation in Vietnam, did you tend to keep track of that like so many other guys did, or did you just try not to pay attention to what day it was and when you were leaving?
Oh, I mean, there was this awareness that, you know, I didn't keep short-timer calendars.
Right.
But I remember some guys did, you know, 365 days, blacking out each day.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, there were some that were like, you know, like based on like a, you know, female news. In fact, there was, you know, a short timer calendar in the BOQ where I lived on the refrigerator that was covered with a sheet, you know, 3-2-1.
Seriously?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But since, you know, it was, people could see it, it was sort of, there was a decorous sheet across the refrigerator door. But I know some of the guys, I mean, they just, you know, they were incredibly creative with these calendars.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But there was this, you know, awareness of like when you got under 100, you were a double-digit midget.
Was that a phrase that was current?
Yes.
Okay.
And then when you got less than 10 days, you were a single-digit midget.
Okay.
But there was also the fear that you weren't safe until you got home. Because, I mean, there were stories about people who got killed on their last day.
Sure.
So, you know, there's this, I guess, superstition that, you know, you talked about it, but there was always this fear that, you know, you weren't safe until you landed.
Yeah. Do you remember... For example, did the guys throw you a party when you were about to leave?
Yes. One of the nine first day back, I mean, part of the traditions of boys camp was that we had farewell parties.
Mm-hmm.
So there were like, you know, a steak cookout, plenty of booze, and then you sign the boys camp flag.
Was that the only time that you signed it, was when you were about to leave?
Yes.
Okay.
And then after you left, it was lowered for, I'm guessing, like 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's, I mean, this is the way we honored
wow.
those who had been with us and who are no longer with us.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there's a lot of sort of ritual about what was done.
Yeah, that's very interesting. These... ritual observations were kind of just generated and observed, even though, you know, people weren't on the same rotations. They were moving through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what the tribe does.
Yes, exactly.
And who knows? I have no idea where it came from. It just
it started somehow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it was well established by the time I got there.
Did
so, you know, when also with the farewell party, it was also for Sheldon Nicol, N-I-C-O-L, who left within a few days after I did.
Was he a specialist or one of the specialist physicians?
I think he may have been like an internist.
Okay.
Or he may have been a 3100, but with some internal medicine training. But he was a friend of mine, and I've got Sri Hawes, and I think Lou gave him and gave me, it's sort of like David Letterman's 10 reasons to stay in Vietnam. And basically, like, you know, we wish you to stay because we'll miss you when you're gone at the very end. But I think the other thing, I think they were the ones who were responsible, I'm not exactly sure it was, but Sheldon and I got, you know, orders that said we had been retained in Vietnam indefinitely. And this is a practical joke.
Oh, God.
And, you know, we both got the orders. And as I remember, we both didn't say anything. And then we just went back to our hooches and sat. And they had to come get us.
How long did they let this go?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think very long. But it was like, you know, and it's like, then what could we say? And they said, well, you know, actually, we're sorry. It was a practical joke, but we don't want you to go. That, you know, we like you. But it's like, you know, it's like getting the orders to go to begin with. Like, and, you know, I destroyed those. I don't want these floating around anywhere.
Yeah, that's pretty hard. That's hard to take.
Wow. Yeah, it was really hard to take. I mean, it was like, they were real. I mean, they had cut them in, actually, the personnel office of the orthopedic room.
I mean, stepping away, it was, to have finessed this and gotten it together was pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we were both used to, you know, looking at orders and seeing what they look like. Like, they look like the real things. But, like, you know, your tour of duty has been indefinitely extended.
But as you point out, Jim, what they were trying to say was that they, you know, felt something about you leaving.
Yeah, exactly.
And how did you feel about leaving them?
I missed the people. I didn't miss the circumstances.
Yeah.
That, you know, that I was just so relieved to get away from that place. But in some ways, you don't get away from it. Because I remember, like, when I got to Sandia Army Base in Albuquerque, I went hiking up in the mountains, and I was walking on the shoulder of one of the highways, and like, no, you can't walk here. It might be mined. You got to get back on the pavement. And like, no, this is perfectly safe. No, it isn't. Because, I mean, you spend a year of doing things that are safe. You know, that the mines were on the shoulders, so you don't walk on the shoulders of the roads. So it's like, you know, what I had was not nearly as bad as what other people had. Like, you know, people who were fighting.
Right.
But it was still this mindset done this for a year. It's not safe to quit doing it yet. And, you know, that was at one level. The other level, like, no, it's safe.
And you're having this internal dialogue about it.
You're having an internal dialogue, but I went back to the BOQ, like, no,
Jim, let's take a break.
Sure.